Well, good morning once again, everyone. This is the first Dhamma talk in the morning of our retreat, and I thought it may be a good idea to talk a bit about the different meditation techniques in some more length, so that it's clear what we are doing. You may have been practicing under different teachers already. I understand most of you are already meditating, but most of you are here for the first time for a longish retreat. And each meditation teacher has his or her own way of teaching. And there are within Buddhism and even within the Theravada Buddhist tradition and even within Vipassana or mindfulness meditation also so many different ways of teaching it. And if you would follow every teacher at the same time, or if you would try to apply those kind of techniques at the same time, it would be rather confusing sometimes. There is a book written by Jack Kornfield, Living Buddhist Masters, and those are the teachers who he had been with, and in Thailand and in Burma, especially, and also in India. As a Buddhist monk, he lived for about 14 years, I think, there. And he described their different approaches, their different teachings, their techniques. And some would say, strive hard, do your best, and you know, concentrate, and put forth your energy. And others would say, just let it go, just be where you are, don't do anything. And those are like two extremes of a whole scala of possibilities of how to approach your technique. And I may be somewhere in the middle of those two. So it may be a good idea that during this retreat you give it a try, the kind of techniques that I'm giving, the guided meditations, see how it works for you. And then you can always go back to your own practice, whatever you have been used to later on, and see what it does for you as you give it an open-minded sort of welcoming approach. So let us first talk a bit about the metta bhavana, the meditation on loving-kindness. As I mentioned yesterday, the word metta comes from the word mitra, which is friend. And this friendliness is meant to be extended to all beings, as we are doing also in the morning. It's first of all a way of overcoming negativities in your own mind. That is like the aspiration or the kind of wish that we do at the beginning. May I be free from anger and fear. May I be free from greed, hatred, and delusion. May I be free from conflict and suffering. And then I say, dukkha, that word is the Pali word, which means as much as you know, conflict and suffering or unsatisfactoriness. So the word dukkha, we will explain later on in the Dhamma talk in the evening, probably I will talk about it, has quite a few shades of meaning, but generally it is a kind of uneasiness and an unsatisfactory state, and may I be free from that conflict and suffering. So that is the wish to be free from the negativities, and then the wish to be, well, peaceful and happy. And that is first to be practiced towards yourself and then to others. And we include human beings and animals, the visible and the invisible. Now, that doesn't mean that those who are in sight and those whom are too far away to see, but also those beings whom we cannot see with our physical eyes, even if they are around you, such as kind of angelical beings or devas, which we call those subtle beings who are in a happy state or sometimes in an unhappy state. May they also be well, peaceful and happy. Buddha actually in his discourse on metta, in the Metta Sutta or the Karaniya Metta Sutta, included all those beings. And he said, just like a mother loves her child, and if it's an only child especially, she would even defend it with her own life, try to extend such love, not with the attachments that come along with motherly love, but the pure motherly love, which is unconditional, to all beings. And that is not always so easy, because we do have issues with some people. And like Snoopy said, you know, I love the whole of humanity, but it is only certain people whom I really hate. Well, that's easier said than done, to love all human or all beings. But we can try to work on it. And the Buddha has given some indications on how to go about it. He says, try to just have loving kindness for a person whom you already respect, for instance, whom you care for and respect. Send them loving kindness. That's the easiest. And then try to send that to people who are neutral to you, sort of neither friends nor foes, and extend this loving kindness that they may be well, peaceful and happy to them. And when you can do that, you have already taken another hurdle, then try to, you know, it's a process that you do over time, not in one meditation, but when you have managed to overcome these dislikes towards certain people, then perhaps you can try to extend loving kindness to those whom you do not like, with whom you have a problem, maybe even your enemy. And if you can do that, then you have really perfected the universal loving kindness. And that in itself is considered to be a protection to yourself. Metta bhavana is one of four what is called araka bhavanas, or the protective meditations. There are others, which I may not need to mention right now, but metta bhavana is one of them. And so when we are practicing this, and I ask to, you know, it's like a visualization almost, that may all humans and animals, visible and invisible, and then in the different directions, when you do that, and you sort of repeat that either verbally or intentionally after me, it sort of builds up an energy of loving kindness. It is a very good, skillful intention and thought and feeling, emotion, you could say a positive emotion in your mind, and it sort of reverberates in the environment also. Like, for instance, when a person who has a lot of love and compassion walks into the room, you feel different from when a person who is angry and, you know, hateful and in a hurry and so walks into a room. You get quite a different feeling. So we do emit these kind of vibrations or thoughts, and we can either pollute the psychosphere, or we can purify it with our own thoughts and intentions, and sometimes with our words and actions also. But everything basically starts in the mind. The Buddha said, the mind is the forerunner of all states. When you have a mind that is based on unskillful or negative states, such as greed, hatred, anger, and delusion, and jealousy, for instance, as a form, then you will experience some bad results to yourself even as a result of your thoughts and your words based on those negativities and your actions based on those negativities. So those are called unskillful roots in your mind, which we are trying to uproot and, first of all, recondition to more positive emotions and positive thoughts. That is, the absence of greed, hatred, delusion, or the presence of, well, let's say, generosity, loving-kindness, compassion, and wisdom. So those kind of states in mind, they're called skillful because they lead to the peace and happiness and the prosperity of yourself as well as that of others. And therefore, it is much better to develop such thoughts, even starting within your own mind and then sort of sending them out into the environment in different directions. Animals, for instance, are very sensitive to people. When you have a loving and friendly person coming to a dog, for instance, they will like it. If a person is very aggressive, then even a snake also might bite you out of fear for that person. And in that way, that vibration or whatever it is that goes along with these negative thoughts in your environment can be changed to the more skillful side. And that is one of the reasons why we are practicing loving-kindness meditation or metta bhavana. And this is when we do this at the beginning of our meditation, after we have settled into our sitting position, a kind of softening up of our mind. You do not necessarily have to do that at every sitting that you do, but it is quite good even for a few moments, and even to start the day and to finish the day with these kinds of metta bhavana, if you do sit down for meditation at the beginning, at the end of the day, in your daily life. Metta bhavana is a very good thing to practice. And in your daily life also, just to keep that attitude of friendliness towards others is also a very good and positive way, where you find that that really helps even in personal relationships, relationship with your boss or with your parents or with your friends or teachers or whomever you may have, or subordinates if you have any in the office. It really helps to give a positive atmosphere in the interaction between people. You know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama always has this kind of universal loving kindness in his mind and friendliness and compassion. And he smiles at people, and sometimes people wonder, why is he smiling at me? You know, what does he want from me, or something like that. And then Dalai Lama says, yes, well, that is their problem, really. I just smile at them and I wish them all the best. So without expecting anything in return, really. So that is what I would like to say about our metta bhavana, the development of loving kindness. And then a few words about the anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing. That is also, well, one of the basic techniques really in the Buddhist meditation, anapanasati, bhavana. Here bhavana, you know, in the bhavana society, the word bhavana comes. Bhavana means something like meditation, or literally development of your mind. But not the kind of development that you do in school, like, and in college, where you learn a lot of things and facts and you have to by heart a lot of figures and read a lot and accumulate a lot of information. That is one type of development of the mind. But in the case of bhavana, it is a different kind of development. The development of, for instance, loving-kindness, development of compassion, development of patience, development of mindfulness, all these kind of good qualities are a type of bhavana, mental development. And in the case of anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, it is said that Prince Siddhartha, you know, who was the bodhisattva, the prince who later became the Buddha at the age of 35, our Sakyamuni Buddha, who is the historical Buddha whose teachings we are following, when he was very young, around 7 years old, his father, King Suddhodana, was having a plowing ceremony. That is, at the time when the fields are being plowed, the king is supposed to do the first plowing. Even nowadays in Thailand, King Bhumibol still does it. And that is a big ceremony. And at that time, apparently Prince Siddhartha was just focusing on that plow going through the ground, and he got very absorbed in that. But then he turned away and he sat down under a little tree. They call it jambu tree or rose apple tree. And he started focusing on his breathing. And he got into what is called absorption state on his breathing. He didn't feel anything but the breath. And it came along with a very, very happy feeling, a deep sense of bliss. And that apparently has stuck to his mind, or he remembered that when he later on in life, you know, at the age of 29, had left the palace and went into ascetic practices and also developed this anapanasati, or mindfulness of breathing, as a technique to focus your mind, to get more concentration of mind and get absorption into an object. Now, absorption into objects could be external objects or an internal object, and the breathing is a kind of an internal object. It's not a mental object, it's a physical object. It's always with you. It doesn't weigh anything, and you don't have to pay overweight when you do it in the plane, for instance. You always carry it with you, but maybe it's a little difficult when you are talking and typing and on the phone to practice mindfulness of breathing, but you can practice it sort of in between periods, or you can set a certain time apart for the practice of mindfulness of breathing. And one of the things that is being done, there are different techniques. One of them is the idea of a carpenter who is sawing a piece of wood. Let's say a carpenter has a saw and he is cutting a plank with this saw. And he's sawing and the saw is going up and down, but his head is not going left and right to follow the saw, but his concentration is on the point where the saw is cutting the wood. Similarly, you know that your breath is going in and out, but you're not supposed to follow the breath inside and out. Some people do, and there are also different techniques in yoga, especially in the pranayama technique, where you are doing deep breathing, following the breath inside and out of the body. But here it is a matter of just focusing your attention on the point where the air touches. Just like the saw is touching the wood, the air is touching here. So you keep your focal point there and know at the same time the breath is going in, the breath is going out. That is one technique to focus your mind. And maybe I can just mention another one which some people do in the beginning of the practice, that is the counting of your breathing. And since it is mindfulness of breathing and not just breathing and also not just counting, it is with the emphasis on the mindfulness that you feel the breath. But the counting technique is supposed to help you to keep your thinking mind on the subject, so, or the object. And in this case, the touch sensation of the breath. So if you would count, for instance, you breathe in and out, you count one at the end of the first out-breath. That's how it's being taught in the books. And then you keep that one in mind as you're breathing in, the second one. And as you finish the second out-breath, you start counting two. And as you're going in and out again, start counting three. But if you notice that you have lost your mindfulness of breathing, you're supposed to go back to zero and start again with one, two, three, and try to go up to five. If you are able to really be mindful of your breathing for five full breaths, that's already quite an achievement, I would say. Since our mind is so much like a monkey jumping here and there, very often there will be periods that you're not really focusing on the breath. There was one monk, you know, he had been practicing a different technique, that is the walking meditation, and he made a resolution in his mind. Whenever his mind was wandering, he would stop walking. And you can see him walking one step and stopping. And then again, one step, stopping. Because every time between these two steps, his mind was wandering. And he was trying to focus on his walking so much, like we are doing with the Anapanasati. But every time that the mind goes off, I wouldn't say stop breathing, but just go back to counting from one again. And then if you find that helpful, some people don't find it helpful, so you can discard it if you don't, but if you find it helpful that you stay with your breathing longer and longer, try to go up to five, then go back to one and up to six, back to one, up to seven, and eventually up to ten. If you can manage that many, that is 5 plus 6 plus 7 plus 8 plus 9 plus 10, that's quite a long period, then you are developing your concentration power on the breathing. And then it is advised not to go beyond 10, because some people are counting and then they go 273, 275, and they have lost the touch of the breath. They are not really watching the breath, they're just counting. So if you are going back again to 1 and up to 10, then that also helps to be mindful of the fact that you're counting and not just counting mindlessly. So you can see what you can do with that. It is rather difficult to guide that sort of a meditation because, everybody is counting in different ways. Then some have to go back to one every moment, others are going further. But it's not necessary to use this technique, but you can try it out maybe in the afternoon when you have the individual, or it's a group sitting, but I will be doing the individual interviews at that time. And then you can apply this technique and see how it works in your anapanasati bhavana, the development of mindfulness on breathing. You can either use that parable of the saw and just imagine, you know, the saw is going up and down or the breath is going in and out, but I'm going to focus on that particular point where the air touches. And that is one helpful technique. If you don't find that helpful, you can try out the counting. And just for your information, you know, it is not just the breath which we have to keep in mind, but for starters, so to speak, we usually try to increase the span of our attention and then use the breath as the most neutral and natural object that we have. Another advantage of that is, since the breath and the mind are interrelated, in the sense that, for instance, if you are very calm and quiet, you might notice that your breathing is very shallow and very smooth and maybe short. Whereas if you're angry or excited or fearful, your breath is hectic. And so the state of mind and the rhythm of your breathing are interrelated in a way. And so by giving your attention to the breath, you can also achieve more calmness of mind and tranquility through that. And if you manage to get absorbed in the breath, then you might reach stages of what is called deeper absorption, jhanas. So I'm personally not a teacher of jhanas, although I have done this in different technique in yoga before, long ago. But I think it's not absolutely necessary to get into the deep absorptions. And also, practically speaking, even in a 5-day retreat, it's not very long. It's sort of medium long. You see, there are 10-day retreats, there are 1-month long retreats, there are 3-month retreats. Then perhaps if you spend longer time on the Anapanasati, you could get into these absorptions if you want. But then, whether that is absolutely necessary is yet another question. It may have some benefit for, let's say, getting into deeper states of concentration if you use it for the development of your mindfulness as well. Mindfulness based on tranquility can lead sometimes to deeper insights. But to get insight, which is actually the aim of our meditation, we call it insight meditation or vipassana, is more important than whether you can or cannot get into these absorptions or deep states of tranquility. And since most of you probably are sort of busy in daily life and you have a lot of things to do, you cannot expect your mind to get into that state of deep concentration and absorption whenever you sit down. Because you will probably notice that when you sit down and try to quieten your mind, you really find how not tranquil it is, how many thoughts there are that come up, especially at the beginning of a retreat or at the beginning of an individual sitting, you start noticing how many thoughts actually do arise. And then if you would think that my meditation is only successful if I can get into these deep levels of tranquility and absorption, then you might feel like a failure in the meditation because you don't get that kind of concentration. But fortunately, the Buddha was wise enough to see that that kind of absorption is not absolutely necessary. More important is that you are aware of what's happening, and with that awareness also have some kind of what is called equanimity, even-mindedness. It's not carelessness, you know, that you don't care, but not to get upset by, let's say, this or that, maybe whether you are restless or whether you are angry or attached or whatever, but whether you are concentrated or not concentrated, keep the equanimity going with a little bit of detachment. Mindfulness, equanimity, and detachment is a very good combination. And then if you can, concentrate your mind on one object like the Anapana, fine and well. If you cannot, then there are always the other objects which present themselves. Sometimes, and very often I would say, you will find that there is another object that, for instance, a pain in your knee, which doesn't go away, or something else. Now, if that is the case, and you feel that this pain is disturbing my meditation because I cannot focus on the breath, my mind goes always to the knee or to that pain, wherever it may be, then the wisest thing is to just accept that and let go of the breath and focus on that object which really calls your attention, which is predominant. And then, as I mentioned, befriend it, sort of embrace it, accept it, and not fight it, and look at it, and see what it is. And then sometimes you can start seeing how it dissolves also. It doesn't become a problem. Whereas if you are fighting it and have a negative attitude towards it and hate it, and then you're more engaged in it and it really becomes a disturbance. So these other objects are not to be seen as disturbances, but just as another object. If you can neglect it and go back to the breath immediately, it's okay. But if it really draws your attention, I would say, just give it your full attention for some time and see what happens. Well, 30 minutes seem to be going very fast. This was some of the technique of our meditation, and now we could probably continue with the actual practice of the meditation.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.